Good evening, everyone. If you would, grab a Bible. Let's turn to Leviticus chapter 24 to start. Leviticus chapter 24. We'll be reading from that place in just a moment. As you can see on the board, we're doing Q&A tonight. I want to say a word of welcome to all our visitors. Glad to see you and glad to have you with us. We want you to always feel welcome among us and do want you to know what we're doing tonight is not intended to be like an open question where we're going to go back and forth. These are questions that have been previously submitted to me. And I prepared some answers for them so that we can have a Bible study that is answering your questions and your curiosities, things that you have brought up as challenges or questions that you have as you read the text. But we're thankful for our visitors. We always want you to feel a part of what we're doing. And if we can help you in some way to know more about the Lord, please let us know about that. Thank you for being here tonight. So Q&A night, we have three questions tonight. As I've mentioned before, sometimes these are completely unrelated, and that will be the case tonight. So we'll get a little whiplash as we go from question one to two and two to three, but that'll just make it fun. That'll keep us all on our toes, right? So about 10 minutes in, if you don't like this sermon, don't worry. I'm going to change the channel. We'll move to a different sermon. Leviticus 24. So what we're going to read this passage for, I want to start with this first question, which is... what makes a bad word bad? And then a follow-up question, what about substitutes for bad words or some high... call them euphemisms, that's a common term for that, words that are a little less bad, considered a little less offensive. What do we say about that? And what is the logic behind saying there are words that we shouldn't say or curse words? So the major concern in the Bible about words that we should not say is the word blasphemy, the way we talk about God. And so I want to start there in Leviticus 24, and I want to read this passage with you starting in verse 10. Leviticus 24 and verse 10, it says, "Now an Israelite woman's son, whose father was an Egyptian, went out among the people of Israel, and the Israelite's woman's son and a man of Israel fought in the camp, and the Israelite woman's son blasphemed the name and cursed. Then they brought him to Moses. His mother's name was Shelomith, the daughter of Dibri of the tribe of Dan, and they put him in custody till the will of the Lord should be clear to them. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, 'Bring out of the camp the one who cursed, and let all who heard him lay their hands on his head, and let all the congregation stone him. And speak to the people of Israel, saying, Whoever curses his God shall bear his sin. Whoever blasphemes the name of the Lord shall surely be put to death. All the congregation shall stone him. The sojourner as well as the native, when he blasphemes the name, shall be put to death.'" So you can see here, blasphemy is the problem, using the name of God in an improper way. This man is in a fight, and in the fight, he says something, probably in anger or frustration, as we people are known to do. We all do this, where there are exclamations we offer, and he says something about the name of God in a way that he shouldn't. And so here you can see blasphemy is the problem, or cursing God, and God is obviously very sensitive to that. And so this man is killed for that. He is stoned for that. So part of the issue here when we talk about what makes that word bad is not that God's name is wrong or bad. It's not a word that you shouldn't say. It's that pulling that out of its proper context means saying something about God we're not really intending to say. It is profaning it, and there is not the proper reverence that it should be used for. Now, Brother Phil read for us from James 3, and James actually makes an important extension of this idea, cursing God, and then the idea of, well, we can say something about God, but then the question is, do we also curse people? And in that text, James says, we bless God, and we say good things about God, and then we turn around and we curse one another. Well, that's a little different, isn't it? It's not that we say one another's names, and, you know, we just say it in such an awful way. Oh, Ethan. And that becomes so bad that, like, now I've cursed because I said Ethan's name in the most ugly way. No, it's just, that's just the nature of names. We don't curse them by saying the name. There are words we say to them that are intended to cut down, the same way that we're profaning God's name, using God's name inappropriately. And so that word, blasphemy, is used in the New Testament like this. This is Colossians 3:8. In Colossians 3:8, it says, "But now you must put them all away, anger, wrath, malice, slander, and obscene talk from your mouth." That word slander is the Greek word blasphemy. But you can see in this text, it's not talking about cursing God. It's instead talking about talking bad about other people, running them down, slandering them. And so that is the idea of blasphemy in the New Testament. I can dishonor God, but I can also dishonor my brother, and I can talk to him in a way that's inappropriate. I can curse him. There is also this word, I want you to notice, I've underlined it too, in my version in Colossians 3:8, it says the word obscene talk. You're reading the King James, it says filthy communication. If you're reading the New American Standard, it says abusive speech. If you're reading the NIV, it says filthy language, vulgar words, obscene words, degrading words, destructive words. So I want you to hear all of those ideas are in play when you come to what the New Testament says about speech. That yes, we should talk about God in the proper way, we should also talk about one another in the proper way, and then we should just kind of talk in the proper way. There's just some things you don't say. There's just some things you don't talk about, and just because you may know the word, or just because it may refer to something that is true, doesn't mean it should be said. Let's go over to Ephesians chapter 4. I want to let Ephesians 4 kind of set the rest of this answer for us. Ephesians 4 and a little bit from Ephesians 5. This is Ephesians 4, and I want to read verse 29. Ephesians 4 and verse 29 says, "Let no corrupting talk come out of your mouths, but only such as is good for building up as fits the occasion, that it may give grace to those who hear." So corrupting talk, the word means, and corrupting, it means diseased or rotten talk. Okay, something that is going to not only reveal some of the corruption and rot in my heart, but it's also going to corrupt and make you a little bit rotten. You're going to be a little worse for having heard my corrupting talk. So he says, don't let that come out of your mouth, but, verse 29, but what is good for building up, that gives grace to those who hear, so that when you hear me talk, you're going to be better, you're going to be built up, you're going to be stronger than if I had not spoken. Look in chapter 5 and verse 3, Ephesians 5 and verse 3. It says, but sexual immorality and all impurity or covetousness must not even be named among you as is proper among saints. Let there be no filthiness, nor foolish talk, nor crude joking, which are out of place, but instead let there be thanksgiving. And then in verse 12, it says, for it is shameful even to speak of the things that they do in secret. So I think what he is describing here is that there are just some things that are not appropriate to be discussed. I don't think that means that we can't, you know, say, hey, this is happening, this is a thing that is real, or this is a thing that has gone on in the past. I think instead there is, you know, sort of a making light of that, where he talks about foolish talk and crude joking, that we're not taking these things with the seriousness that sin deserves, and so we're sort of making light of them. So you can see there are parameters around our speech. So I want you to think about that. As I answer this question, what makes a bad word bad? I want you to see there's a broad range of what we're actually talking about when we talk about God's will for our speaking. It seems to me that in English, there are really three arenas of cuss words, curse words, or offensive words. There is one set of words that are about things that deserve respect or things that are holy, like spiritual things or religious things. And I don't know if you've thought about it, but in English, there are a number of cuss words that are just religious terms taken out of context. They have to do with God or Jesus or Christ. Or when we talk about hell out of context, or we talk about condemning or damning someone out of context, these words are not bad. They're just usually used in a way that we're not really talking about the concept. Sometimes, especially when you take the idea of condemning someone or wanting them to go to hell, it can be a form of just extreme offensiveness. I hate you to the degree that I wish you were condemned for eternity. And you can hear how that would be a pretty intense thing to say. I just think in our time it's kind of lost some of that historical context. But there is that set of terms that is religious terms, sort of like Leviticus 24. We're taking all those and then pulling them into, you know, everyday speech and context where they kind of have the heat of the spiritual thing but without the real meaning of it. Then there are some things in English that are improper to discuss in certain ways or certain times. I'm really thinking here about bedroom things and bathroom things. That just, you know, there are ways you can talk about those things that are super offensive, and then there are ways you can talk about them that are not offensive. In fact, in that sense, the euphemism or the substitute is actually really helpful. I just did it. I just said bedroom and bathroom, and adults in the room know what I'm talking about, okay? And you know, okay, that's what we're talking about, but we're not describing it, and we're also not being offensive about it, and so it's not the idea that's the problem, but the way it's expressed. And then there's a third category that are just things that are intended to insult people. Okay, remember when Jesus says, don't say raca to your brother, or don't call him you fool? We have a whole set of words in English that are like that, that are just intended to insult. Usually, it's interesting, usually they have to do with intelligence or parentage. in English. I think that's fascinating, but we don't have to go into that. So what I'm getting at is that, you know, there's not one set of things that you say, oh, that's what makes them bad. Because none of those ideas in and of themselves are bad. It's just sort of the way our language has developed. But usually, I will say, if I were to answer the question in one sentence, usually what makes bad words bad in our language is that we're intending to offend with our speech. I want to offend and upset you. I'm going to say things in such a way that you are offended, whether I'm insulting you or just trying to be crass in the way I'm describing something. So I would also add, and I'll talk more about this in a second, this is cultural, this is regional, and this is generational. So I have lived long enough to notice that there are words that when I was young were considered extremely offensive that now are not. And that is weird. Okay, because I hear young people saying things and like it's just sort of common. Now in a way that, and I'm not that old, I don't think, where, you know, like now I look back and that would have never been said when I was a kid, and yet now it is, and now it's accepted. So I think that's important for how we relate to each other. I'll talk about that in a second. But I would just say, if you're going to ask the question, is this a word I should say? First, I think Ephesians 4:29 tells you, don't be offensive in your wording. Let no corrupt word come out of your mouth, but what's good for necessary edification. And then, be aware of the impact of the words you use. Will it tear down or will it build up? And if there is any question about any words you're going to say or any way you're going to say it, just take a beat and rephrase and find a better way to say it. Or just hold off on that. I think it would be much better to not say something than to say something and then try to walk it back because you said it in an offensive way. I am very sensitive to this because I preach, and even now as I'm talking, there is another Jake that's right here listening to everything this Jake is saying and saying, okay, is that coming out right? Is somebody going to hear that way? Because I'll just tell you, I've said the wrong thing from the pulpit before, and it's really hard to undo. Okay, and let's just take that perspective into everyday life, that we need to have the filter on and be aware of how we impact others. The second part of that is, what about euphemisms or substitutes? This would be words like dang or gee or gosh. I will say, I've been involved in those debates in the past. They can get really ridiculous really quickly. I'll just say that, because just about any word can be tied to any other word, and that to me can get really silly. There is no list of words in the Bible we can and cannot say. I think we can cover that. There will always be some gray area in this, and the question is just, how are we going to deal with those gray areas? So again, let me say, don't be offensive. Verse 29 here, give grace to those who hear you. And the other thing I would say is, please be sensitive to some generational differences. Are you aware of the fact that we have multiple generations in this body, in this room right now? Okay, we've got people who are decades and decades older than other people. And there are going to be, and some people who have grown up in different parts of the country or even in other places where, you know, things are differently offensive to different people. So, sometimes young people are going to use words that the older generation finds offensive. Sometimes, I've heard this, older people are going to use words that are no longer in favor in younger generations. And so the younger generation is going to find them offensive. Sometimes that's racial words. Like, wait, hey, we don't say that anymore. Okay? Can we have some grace with each other about this? And if you're concerned or if there's any, you know, issue there, let's just hold off on the words and say, let's say this in a way that we know we can be heard and have some care for each other about it. But I will tell you, none of us gets to tell one another what words we use or don't words we don't we use or don't use. We're not the word police here. But I think it's very different if I come to you and say, hey, that's offensive to me, than if I just say, I'm going to say what I want and you can just deal with it. One of those attitudes is Christian, the other is not. All right, so that's what I would do with that question. All right, ready to change the channel? All right, how can someone work to love your neighbor as yourself when they're struggling to love themselves? Let's go to Matthew chapter 22. That's where this question comes from, Matthew 22. Matthew 22 and verse 34, it says, "But when the Pharisees heard that he had silenced the Sadducees, they gathered together And one of them, a lawyer, asked him a question to test him. Teacher, which is the great commandment in the law? I'm in Matthew 22, verse 37. He said to them, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. This is the great and first commandment. And the second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments depend all the law and the prophets. So he quotes this text in verse 39. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. And I believe that Jesus is quoting this text assuming a healthy view of self. Or perhaps the more common problem, which is an overly strong view of ourselves. The way I take Jesus' statement, the way I take Jesus' tone, is something like this. I know that you love yourself. You have no problem with that. But to obey God, you have to break out of that innate selfishness and expand your love to include other people. You've got to love other people the way you naturally love yourself. And it seems to me that that's just the common way the New Testament does this. Paul has a similar way of expressing himself. This is Philippians 2, 3, and 4. Do nothing from selfish ambition or conceit, but in humility count others more significant than yourselves. Let each of you look not only to his own interests, but also to the interests of others. He says, hey, I know you're going to look out for your interest. Just don't only look out for your interest. Also consider other people. So it assumes a healthy self-view. In fact, I would say maybe an unhealthy, overly selfish view. But he says, you need to expand that so that you view other people that way. Or in Ephesians 5, talking about marriage, in the same way husbands should love their wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself, for no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it just as Christ does the church. So you could say this is common sense. Love your wife like you love your own body. You don't hate your own body. You don't try to hurt your own body. You take care of yourself. Expand that self-care to include her. And I'm sure there are people probably here in this room who are reading that and saying, yeah, well, no one ever hated his own flesh. I don't know about that. I know I sometimes don't feel that way about my own body, or I know people who don't feel that way. I understand that, but please hear what he's trying to say. What he's trying to say is this is sort of the natural way people are, and now there is instruction based on that. Love your wife the way you love yourself. So the nature of the question then is, what if that's not true? What if I'm having trouble loving myself? I don't love my own flesh. I don't look out for my own interests. And so to love my neighbor as myself, I don't even know what I would do with that. So I'll give you a few of my answers to that question. The first is, how you feel about yourself is not a requirement for fulfilling the verse. Look again at verse 39 of Matthew 22. It says, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Jesus is not saying that you can only love other people when your self-concept is awesome. He is saying, love them, and then use ordinary ideas like self-concepts that are the usual self-concept to describe the degree and scope of your love. Love them like you should be loving yourself. Love them in that way. So I don't think what he's saying is you can only do this when you feel this way. Instead, he's saying that's the degree to which God expects you to love. So there is some work that you may need to do on yourself, but don't wait on that before you love other people. I think that's the first thing I would say. The second thing I would say is if you're in that struggle, don't confuse love with a feeling. I think that's a mistake we often make. Notice that Jesus says there are two commands that are the above and beyond commands, and they are both love commands. Love God, love neighbor. Those are the commands. They are commanded. There are things to be done, not just felt. And I will say of anybody in this room that even when you love people, that doesn't always mean you feel certain feelings toward them. Feelings kind of ebb and flow. But there are things we can do that love would expect us to do, or that love would require us to do, that we do because those are the things love does. So don't confuse those two. I'll remind you, this is 1 John 3. By this we know love, that he laid down his life for us. That was an action that teaches us love. And we ought to lay down our lives for the brothers. That's an action we do. But if anyone has this world's goods and sees his brother in need, yet closes his heart against him, how does God's love abide in him? Little children, let us not love in word or talk, but in deed and in truth. Notice, you might think, oh, closes his heart. He's talking about feelings. But here he's actually describing closing the heart as a response that says, I'm not going to help you. I have these goods and I'm not giving them to you. And he says, no, let love be in deed and in truth, an action that we do. So don't confuse love with a feeling. Paul describes love. Love suffers long. Love is kind. Love doesn't insist on its own way. It bears all things. It hopes all things. It believes all things and endures all things. Feelings are going to come and go, but we can love and do what God tells us to do for others. I would also add, before I leave this question, if you're struggling with that self-concept, work to actually help other people as much as you can. I think sometimes with a poor self-concept, we battle, I don't feel like I'm worth anything. I don't feel like I offer anything to anybody. And here, Jesus helps because Jesus says, if you do the smallest thing to one of my brothers, you do it to me. If you give a cup of cold water, that you'll receive a prophet's reward. The smallest thing is something that is special to God and is a part of your service to other people. So don't think that that's something that you have to do some grand work or have some impressive attribute about you before God will accept your service. And just remember, along the way, as you do that, as you continue to love and you try to make those changes, I think there should be some work done here on that self-concept. If you don't love yourself and you feel like you're worthless, just remember that God does not feel that way about you. Remember that God loved you enough to send his son to die for you. Remember that God is the Father waiting on you to come home and who kills the fatted calf for you. And maybe you don't like you, and I understand that, but there is work to be done to say, I want to listen to God's voice instead of the voice that's in my head telling me I'm not worth as much. So I think along the way, I can still love people, but there needs to be some concurrent work on myself. So that would be what I would say in answer to that question. All right, let's change the channel again. Third question, this will be the last one we cover tonight. How does Matthew 18, 15 to 17 apply to marriage? Let's turn over to that text, Matthew 18. Specifically, this question is asking whether this passage means that we can't ask for help when we have a serious problem in our marriage from someone outside the marriage. And you'll see why we get to that point as you read the text with me. Matthew 18 and verse 15. Matthew 18, 15, if your brother sins against you, go and tell him his fault between you and him alone. If he listens to you, you have gained your brother. But if he does not listen, take one or two others along with you that every charge may be established by the evidence of two or three witnesses. If he refuses to listen to them, tell it to the church. And if he refuses to listen even to the church, let him be to you as a Gentile and a tax collector. So again, the question is, as you see that pattern, does that mean that we cannot deal with a marriage by reaching outside the marriage and getting help from others? Now, the crux of the teaching in this text is that when wrong is done, we go and talk directly to the person who has wronged us one-on-one. That's verse 15. If your brother sins against you, go and tell him his fault between you and him alone. And the goal is to rebuild the relationship, to end the problem. If he hears you, he says in verse 15, you have gained your brother. I want to be clear that this is a sin against you issue in verse 15. A sin against you. This is not, oh, you know, I didn't like something you said. That kind of bothered me. But sin's involved. So that if it's not resolved, there is an issue between this person and God because they have sinned against God. But I will say, even though that's true, I believe direct discussion is the best way to resolve almost every kind of conflict. Let's just talk about it. And that especially includes marriage, where when we have an issue with one another, very often we get into dangerous problem patterns where we do not resolve a conflict and it just kind of simmers under the surface. And Jesus is teaching his disciples, when you have this kind of issue, go and talk about it, work through it. Now, in the text, as it progresses, if that one-on-one approach doesn't successfully resolve the problem, verse 16 says that others are brought in to entreat and to resolve. And then verse 17 says, we tell the church, and the church also attempts to reason with the person. And if they will not hear even the church, then there is a withdrawal. They are to be to them like a heathen and a tax collector. Now, there is a sense in which this passage does not apply to marriage, in my judgment, and that is, I still have responsibilities to my mate, whether they are obeying the gospel or not. And those responsibilities, I don't believe, change. So I don't believe in that sense it's a one-to-one comparison to marriage. But I do believe that there is a broader sense in which this is very helpful in a marriage for us to learn the skills of resolving problems by talking about them and working through them. And I believe Christian marriages really suffer and struggle from not being able to do that. In fact, sometimes it's because there is no outside help or influences that we just struggle because we don't have those skills. We first get married, we don't know how to deal with conflict, and so we just get into these patterns that persist for years and years and years, and the holes get bigger and the wounds get deeper. So I would encourage you, as I read this passage, it teaches me in my marriage not to let problems simmer indefinitely, to listen to each other and develop problem-solving skills, and to approach each other with tender hearts, and to be forgiving, and to work in the relationship, and to rebuild it. But that's not the question. The thrust of the question is, does this mean I can't tell someone outside the marriage about issues in my marriage? Well, I would say first that the text actually describes telling people outside the marriage. It's in the text. Verse 16 says, go get witnesses. Verse 17 says, tell it to the church. In other words, yes, there are times where there are issues that we need help with in a marriage. Now, that's not an excuse for gossip, nor is it an excuse to not have to talk to my mate about it. I'll go talk to somebody else because I don't want to talk to her or him. But it does imply that sometimes things are going to get over our heads and we need help from our brothers and sisters. And I would also say, and I want you to turn with me to 1 Corinthians 6 as we see this. This will be the last place we go today. 1 Corinthians 6. I also think that there is an expectation in the New Testament era that churches should have wise people who were able to help resolve problems and disputes. Churches should be places where there are wise people we can turn to. Of all the people in the world, these should be the people we trust to be able to help us handle problems. 1 Corinthians 6. 1 Corinthians 6 and verse 1. It says, when one of you has a grievance against another, does he dare go to law before the unrighteous instead of the saints? Or do you not know that the saints will judge the world? And if the world is to be judged by you, are you incompetent to try trivial cases? Do you not know that we are to judge angels? How much more than matters pertaining to this life? So if you have such cases, why do you lay them before those who have no standing in the church? I say this to your shame. Can it be that there is no one among you wise enough to settle a dispute between the brothers, but brother goes to law against brother, and that before unbelievers? To have lawsuits at all with one another is already a defeat for you. Why not rather suffer wrong? Why not rather be defrauded? But you yourselves wrong and defraud even your own brothers. Now it is a strong rebuke, but I don't believe the topic here is lawsuits. I believe the topic here is, how can it be that a church exists where there's no one wise enough to settle an argument? How can that be? How can God's people be wise enough that he thinks they can judge angels and judge the world, and yet we don't think they can judge our own problems and help us? But the implication is that we may need to share our personal issues, disagreements, grievances with wise brothers and sisters who can help us come to resolution. I think it's there in the text. There is an assumption that this is the way local church life will work. And that feels like a principle that's true of any relationship, even marriage. Mark talked about this morning that older women are to train the young women to love their husbands and children. Direct instruction from older sisters about how to live in harmony with husbands and children. And while the same is not said of men, I think it's a safe deduction that that's God's expectation for all people, that even younger men are going to look to older men to say, how do I do this marriage thing? What am I doing wrong? How can I get some help when there are things I don't know what to do about? So, I don't believe Matthew 18 would mean that telling others about a serious or sin-involved problem in my marriage would be wrong. There is a place for Christian counsel. And I believe that's in 1 Corinthians 6 or in Titus 2, as well as in other places. But I will say, I believe the tone and the motive of that request matters. It matters what we're saying and why and how. Am I trying to get people on my side? Is this an argument that I can't win? And so I say, I need to go pull in some bigger guns to get some other people in here to try to convince her that she's wrong and I'm right. I also think that this idea that we can keep things in the family is a cultural thing that is not a biblical idea. I think it can be a very dangerous thing that we think we can only resolve problems among our family. And I think that the revelations of the past, say, 10 or 20 years among different kinds of churches have revealed the limitations of that. That very often what happens is the worst cases of abuse and the worst cases of misconduct are covered up because that's family business and it's nobody else's business. And that's dangerous. It's dangerous for the people who are suffering. But also, what does it say about the church? If we're not capable of helping one another, of resolving conflict, and of sharing the struggles of our hearts and our relationships with one another. The other factor that leads me to the conclusion that we may need at times to reach outside for help is that being forced to keep those serious spiritual and relational problems quiet often leads us to extreme isolation and depression and frustration. And instead of going to the people who are best positioned to help us, we rule that out. We say, no, those people are off limits. Because for some reason, this has to stay in the family. Now, I hope you see potential for abuse on both sides of that. I hope you see it's all over. There's potential for abuse all over this. And you could take my words and twist them however you want. I'm not going for that, but I can understand there is potential here. It's possible for a spouse to manipulate their spouse by telling them, you can't tell anybody about this. It's also possible for those who do go outside the marriage to try to manipulate and to try to use those relationships to put pressure on their spouse or to cover up a serious problem. And it's possible for those of us who, when people come to us, for us to manipulate the situation or to gossip about it or to cover it up or to be dismissive about a serious problem. There is potential for problems all over that. And yet I don't believe that changes the fundamental truth, which is we need each other, particularly in serious situations where we're trying to do right and we need counsel and help. So may God grant us wisdom in those situations. But that's what I would answer to that question. Thank you so much for your attention tonight. We're going to close now with the invitation. This is the time of our service where we offer the opportunity for those who are ready to respond to Jesus and the sacrifice he's made for us and are ready to make a public declaration in some way that you want to be saved by his blood.